Gregoire and Dan Beeston are smart enough to know better.
Welcome to episode 218 of Smart Enough to Know Better.
We are a podcast of science.
And comedy.
And ignorance.
I'm Dan Beeston.
And I'm Gregoire.
And in this episode of Smart Enough to Know Better...
If you walk without rhythm, you won't attract the worm. But if you walk without rhythm, you'll never learn.
And then I collect my recollections.
And I don't want to believe.
But before we get there, what happened to you, Gregoire, this week in science?
Well, happy New Year. Happy 2025. It's all very exciting.
Oh, let's not draw attention to the fact that we're this late in doing the December podcast.
Is this December?
Yeah.
Oh, no. Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, dear. Okay. So we'll cut that bit out then. That's fine.
We're only the second Sunday. We are supposed to be recording next month's podcast. Well, this month's podcast today.
Oh, it's fine. It's fine. Everyone had lovely breaks. It's totally, totally fine.
Everyone's relaxed about that stuff?
I think so. Well, we are.
Obviously.
It's going to be good. For this week in science, I was really excited to see the Parker Solar Probe had done something interesting. So are you aware of the Parker Solar Probe? Have you heard of that one before?
As I understand it, it can't lose.
Wow, that's a deep cut to an 80s TV show, or was it 90s TV show?
That might be early 90s. Oh
my God, terrifying. So the Parker Probe is a solar probe. It's very close to the sun, and it's one of the fastest objects we've ever created, and it's also...
Was it fastest because we did it, like because we made it fast, or because of where we pointed it?
What do you mean?
If I built a rocket and I made it far away from the sun, it would be working against the pull of the gravitational pull of the sun.
Oh, I see.
Whereas if I pointed a rocket that went whizzed right by the sun, it would like whip around like a guy on a water ski.
Yeah, it's not even rocket stuff. It's in fact it's falling in towards the sun and going into very elliptical orbits between Venus and the sun. So it picks up a lot of speed, a lot of velocity.
Yeah, the fastest probe is a bit like saying, oh, it's the fastest sled because we put it on the steepest hill.
No. We made it go that fast. We gave it the trajectory. It didn't just randomly happen or happen by happenstance. We worked out.
No. We put it on the steepest hill.
Yes. Yeah. But that's still not, it's still the fastest probe.
Yeah.
It still is the fastest probe.
But it's not like we didn't engineer it to go faster. If you got all the probes and made them race along the same track, it's not necessarily going to be the fastest probe. It's just that we pointed it.
That's such a weird way of looking at it. No, it is. It's the fastest probe. It is literally the fastest probe. It didn't just happen. It didn't just fall down a hill because the hill is everywhere. It's the gravitational, and it had to go into multiple orbits around, like seven orbits around Venus to get there. I don't disagree. I know what you're saying. It didn't chemically fire a rocket or something like that, but that's not the definition of fastest, nor making something go fast.
Yeah. I understand this. But if it wasn't pointed at the sun, if you just got all the probes.
But it wasn't pointed at the sun.
Well, wherever it pointed on a special track that makes it go fast. It's like a soapbox derby.
Yes.
I guess it's been designed to work the best on that particular track too.
And also, yes, and it won't melt when it gets close to the sun. Yeah, that's pretty.
Happened to my soapbox derby car. That's right. Whoosh.
Too much friction. It's very hard to send things to the sun because you think it'd be easy to, as you just say, just point it and it falls down the hill.
Drop it, yeah.
Yeah, but it doesn't work that way because the Earth has velocity around the sun, and so you have to get rid of that velocity to fall towards the sun. Otherwise, you're going to miss the sun. Actually hit the sun itself is quite difficult.
Yeah, because you're going as fast as fast as the Earth. So yes. if you just let it go, it's just going to keep orbiting around...
Yes.
The sun.
So, and as you get closer in, like a ballerina pulling its arms in, like an ice skater or someone spinning very, very quickly, the closer it gets, you have angular momentum, you're still going to, it's going to get real fast and go, it's going to be very hard to kind of go into orbit around the sun. Or, so the way they did it is they didn't do that. They it made it interact with Venus multiple times. It's this orbit between Venus and the sun. So it does these very wide loops back out to the second planet and then round back to the sun. So it can get really close to the sun and whip through very quickly and keep getting closer and closer. You know, it's done this quite a few times now. But the latest one, it got within 13 million kilometers of the sun's surface. So that's real close. And it was so close, it was inside the sun's, inverted commas, atmosphere. So what's called the chromosphere. So right inside, there's a whole new thing. So it's a, you might have seen on the news, they said the Parker probe touches the sun. What they meant was it's gone inside what we call the chromosphere.
All right.
It's pretty cool. The way it can survive that is because it has a heat shield that it sort of hides behind. And it can handle thousands of degrees temperatures. And so on one side, the pointing towards the sun, it was 1,400 degrees. And on the other side, in the shade, where all the electronics kept, it was kept at 30 degrees Celsius. So it was, you have to be very precise, because if the Parker probe pivots weirdly or, you know, shows a bit of itself that it doesn't, it's all over Red Rover. The whole thing is just, it'll just break down in seconds because it can't handle 1,000. Electronics famously don't handle 1,400 degrees Celsius.
This is like Victorian London all over again. All the ladies dress in like these long dresses, but a hint of ankle and suddenly everything goes on fire.
Exactly right. That's exactly right. What's interesting is the heat shield's only about 11 centimeters thick. So it's not even that thick. It's pretty clever.
Wow.
And it whips around and it whips around and it's got going through the chromosphere. And they're going into the chromosphere because the chromosphere is a very weird, I mean, it's good to see if it can survive it. It did survive it. The chromosphere is very interesting because the surface of the sun is about 6,000 degrees Celsius, roughly. But the chromosphere can be measured into the tens, hundreds of thousands, even, let's say hundreds of thousands of degrees Celsius.
I've never understood that. That's never sat in my brain right.
And you and everyone else, because we don't know how it works. We have some ideas on how it works. We have some theories, but we don't actually know. Why is something away from the surface of the sun much, 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 much hotter than the surface of the sun itself? It feels like saying like you have a lovely campfire at 400 degrees Celsius, but the air next to it where you're standing is 10,000 degrees Celsius.
Yeah.
It feels all colors of red.
Like if the sun was like a big iron ball that had been heated up till it was bright white, like this wouldn't make any sense at all.
Not at all.
It's like, oh, well, it's sort of, it's like, is the fusion only happening on the surface? That's not what's happening.
No, the fusion's all happening at the core. Yeah. There's no fusion. There's no fusion whatsoever. Theory is, this is what the Parker probe the information will help us work out. There is a theory that the magnetic fields, the particles are powered by the powerful magnetic fields that loop out from the surface of the sun. So the particles themselves are given a lot of energy from magnetic fields. So
why does the sun have magnetic fields when it's not iron?
It has, well, that's its problem. It has multiple magnetic fields. Unlike a magnet, which has like everything lovely put together, then you get these north poles and south poles all over the place, and they mix and they spin because the sun, it's a plasma. So the equator of the sun, I think it's once every 30 days roughly, and the Arctic areas, the north and south, they spin at lesser amounts. So it's kind of like they're out of step. So bits are being pulled apart. So these magnetic fields are getting stretched and looped up. That's why we get sunspots, by the way. That's where sunspots come from. That's all the magnetic stuff. And then you get solar flares where these terribly tangled magnetic fields snap and break and just launch crap everywhere. Like a boom, and you know, you get the Carrington event, or you get these massive flares that reach out, do terrible things if they hit us, of course. So yeah,
when they hit us,
well, they definitely do. But it's big. It's a big space, and it hasn't happened yet. Well, it has happened. Last time was Carrington event. Oh, there was one recently, but it wasn't that bad. Anyway, getting off track, the Parker probe did its really cool thing. When you talk about the heat shield, my brain was like, well, hang on a minute. So it's gone into the inverted commas atmosphere of the sun. It's pointing its heat shield at the sun. So that's the radiative heat coming from the sun. That's the infrared. It's stopping the infrared from getting to its components.
Yep.
Keeping it cool. But it's inside the atmosphere of the sun. So what stops it from
having
inductively?
Yeah.
Because it's moving like a bat out of hell through the – so you think it would be plowing through. Imagine if it went through the atmosphere here. It would be plowing through all our atmosphere.
Yes, well, and our atmosphere is quite thick. Yes. How thick is the chromosphere?
The answer is not very at all, and that's the power of it. So
that'd do it.
If you have, it's incredibly sparse, like one atom in like a cubic meter, if not more. It's like it's
but that
huge.
Atom is super hot,
and it is that atom is. Imagine if it's 100,000 degrees, so it's like going crazy, but it's just not enough of them for it to heat up appreciably the probe as it plows through. The analogy
temperature
like
is weird. Maybe we should switch to Fahrenheit just to reflect how crazy temperature is.
No, we should definitely not do that. Definitely should not. There's no benefit to that at all. So the particles, when you think about temperature with particles, temperature is just particles moving. So the more they move, so the hotter we call them, the more they're moving, really. And so you can still have 100,000 degrees Celsius, and it's moving like crazy, but it can't touch anything. It can't pass on its heat. And that's why the Parker probe, when it goes through, isn't heating up, because the radiative energy from the sun is one thing. The conductive energy that it gets from hitting these very, very energetic particles is not enough to really heat it up appreciably. And there's no convective. It's not enough stuff for heat to transfer around like a boiling pot.
Mm.
But when I saw that, I was like, it makes sense, but also like it's so alien to us.
It's counterintuitive.
It really, really, really is. So well done, Parker Probe. Very exciting. And it's not done yet. It's still going to zoom out to Venus and go back. And what I really also like, they were saying, and by the way, while we're going through Venus, because, you know, it's away from the sun, but we're going to use its sensors to try and work out what these dust clouds around Venus are all about, or all these things about Venus. So we could potentially discover something exciting around Venus as well.
Life?
It's never life. We'll get onto that later on in the podcast. So what about your week in science, Dan?
I learned something fascinating about waves.
Ooh.
Because if you go to the beach, you stand on the beach and the waves come to you.
Mm-hmm.
It is the easiest entertainment.
Yes.
But if you're in the ocean, the waves, they just kind of just go all over the place. Like, oh. So the wind whips them up, or the currents do it, and they can interfere with each other and overlap. You get like rogue waves and stuff. Mm. So on the ocean, waves are just, they don't have a direction.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Yep.
Like,
yep.
they point all over the place. So mm-hmm. How do they know to come to the shore so that I can enjoy them?
Sure.
Like, how am I luring
them? Who's scheduling them?
Yeah. How am I luring them in?
Yeah.
And I learned how this works, because waves are going super quick mm-hmm. and they're super long, but not very tall.
Right.
And so if you've got a wave that is going away from you, and you're on the beach and the wave's going away from you, bye-bye, it's gone. Yeah, mm-hmm. It's not coming to you. And if you've got a wave that's coming directly at you, it slows down and it gets bigger because it runs out of room. So it hits mm-hmm. the shallow water and it slows down, and then the wave gets bigger and bigger, and then it crashes on the beach, and you have a lovely little play in the wave. But then if you've got a bunch of waves that are sort of traveling perpendicular to the beach, they're running mm-hmm. north or south, and you're pointing out east, which is yep. how all beaches work, I understand, having grown up in Queensland, Australia. That wave is like this big, wide wave, and the bit that's closest to the beach slows down as it gets into shallow water.
Mm-hmm.
So it slows down the closer it is.
Yep.
It kind of stretches and warps. So instead of being a wave that runs, just goes straight north, it yep. sort of slows down on one side and sort of becomes a big arc. And the arc that points at the beach is the bit that hits you. And it's the one that you can see. So
you've discovered refraction, by the way.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I'm amazing. I'm like this amazing scientist.
Where you're describing that, I'm like, yes, as a light wave or even a sound wave enters a new medium, you know, from air into glass, it slows down and then changes direction. Snell's law, there's an angle you can calculate. I was like, oh, Dan's discovered refraction. That's yeah. amazing. That's
it
very cool.
It is amazing.
I will say this, I'd never thought about water waves in that way, and I'd never thought about why they seem to come at you. So that's pretty cool. It's like, I had made that connection before. It's refracting towards you.
Yeah. And so you just get to enjoy them one after the other then.
That is very cool. If you'd asked me before I'd heard that, I would have said that it's also because they get focused in due to the bay you're in or something like that. But that doesn't make sense if you're standing on the west coast of Australia, like 5,000 kilometres of Western Australia, where there is no coves. It's just one big long light. Well,
great big one line.
Yeah, and then but the waves are still coming towards you.
Yeah.
So you've absolutely hit it on the head. Like, how the heck did they change that direction? And it's due to the shallow water, not to do with a bay or something. Well, technically it is the bay. You know what I mean? It's not like being focused in like on a concave area or a convex area.
It's being unfocused. If anything, it's all it starts to curve away from a central energy source.
Yeah, it's line of motion, and then it curves in. So it curves in. Interesting, isn't it? Technically, the shallow water is behaving like a thicker material.
Yeah.
So it comes towards you. It gives you the same effect anyway. But it'd be interesting if it had worked the other way, which it wouldn't due to the way. But because then the waves, you'd never see waves on a beach. The waves would go away. It can't work that way. I realize as I said that, to maybe that's a bit.
Well, then you'd have like really deep water just at the shoreline and then a shoreline. And so it'd be really deep. And then would it just like splash up randomly?
Maybe. Yeah. I don't know. We're talking about really changed physics at that point. So I'm not too sure how that would work. But yeah, that's really, it's interesting. So the analogy for a thicker substance or a more dense subject, I should say, is shallow water. Interesting.
Yeah.
There must be wave tanks that use that connection to show how refraction works. As in, you could set up a wave tank and show someone how light waves propagate through a new medium with a shallower section of the tank, because then you could say this is glass and this is air, and then you could show it. But yeah, there must be someone must have used this already. I can't believe that no one would have used
I just discovered it. Like, let's see what springs from that.
Is it the Beeston effect? That's what we're calling it.
Yes, the Beeston wave effect.
But yeah, excellent. Well done. Congratulations. Put a flag on it. Boop.
Boom. Two flags. Swim between them.
Many years ago, I was in Perth and I was out for a jog in the afternoon. I noticed something over Kings Park. And those who don't know Perth, Kings Park is on top of a hill. Technically, it's a mountain, but, Australia mountains, we don't talk about them very much. And it's right next to the city centre. And I was a couple of kilometres away at the Swan River level. And there was a light above Kings Park. I wasn't looking at it directly all the time, but I was like, what is that light? And I was like, it was really bright and it was just sort of hovering over the park. And I was
newborn like, king? So newborn king of humans? Like brand new king. Get some wise men over there.
Right. Yes. Well, I was trying to work out what star was it? What was it? But the more I kept looking at it, the more I was like, I don't know what this is. And it looked like it was hovering over Kings Park. I was like, is it a helicopter? Is it a plane coming in? And I kept looking at it. And I could not work out what it was.
So it was unidentified, is what you're saying.
It was an unidentified flying object. And to the point where I started to go, okay, now I'm getting weirded out. As in, I don't understand what it is. For 5 minutes or so, this thing hovered over Kings Park. And I was like going, what is, and it was super bright. And I couldn't work out.
Sucking up cows.
And no one else seemed to care around me because it was just a light, but a bright light in the sky. So that's why I thought it's probably a plane coming in, but it didn't turn off. It didn't get, didn't get closer. And my brain went, it must be a helicopter. It must just be a helicopter hovering over, Kings Park. Anyway, in the end, I got too interested. I stopped running, took out my phone app, which has like Star Walk on it, and I pointed at it and I discovered it was Jupiter.
Ah. And you know Jupiter.
I know Jupiter.
You're friends with Jupiter.
Me and Jupiter are best buddies.
How did you miss that, Mr. Astronomer?
It's a very good question. It was sitting above Kings Park. It was dropping down. So the planet was rotating, but it was getting closer to the horizon. And I think it was the fact that it was my brain getting confused by looking at Kings Park and understanding where that was and seeing a bright light above it, like just above it, and that was looked like it was over it, that my brain made a lot of assumptions.
Ah.
And because I was running as well, I think there was apparent motion from it, even though it was stock still in the sky. My brain was interpreting my motion as its motion in reverse. It's a whole thing. I don't know. It got me, right? It got me. For 5 minutes, I started to have a moment. And I'm not that guy. Those who don't know, until quite recently, I used to take people out and look at the sky professionally at night and, you know, with telescopes and things and teach students about it and all that sort of stuff. So I know the night sky pretty well. Right. And it still got me. Still, and it's always been a really good lesson that you don't know what's in the sky.
I had a similar situation where I was like, what is that cigar-shaped object? Like,
oh, no.
Like an actual proper flying saucer. I'm like, what am I looking at here? That is so weird. It's obviously not a plane. It's obviously not a helicopter. I don't think it's a balloon. Is that some sort of blimp or something? It's like, it's weird. It's got the same sort of shape as my kitchen lights. Like really, if I had to explain, it looks just like my kitchen. It was a reflection in the window. Yeah. I'm looking in the sky. I go, that looks just like my kitchen light.
And it's funny how it takes your brain. Why I'm mentioning this, and your story also really helps a lot. Thank you.
Now you don't feel like the dumbest person in the room.
Look, we'll get into this soon. End of last year, there was a surge of UAP sightings, so unidentified aerial phenomena, because right now even UFOs need to glow up, it seems, or rebranding every so often, because, you know, UFOs are silly and crazy, but UAPs, whoo, it's all about UAPs now.
I mean, I totally understand that, because UFO had a proper thing. Like, a UFO is a thing. It's just a flying object that we haven't identified yet.
Yes.
But if you say UFO, you're immediately putting into people's brains little green men.
That's right. So they've tried to get away from going UAP, but they still want you, what they're saying, UAP, also little green men. That's they're not really saying we don't. When people say UAP, they're not saying, I don't know what this is. What they're really saying is,
look, the first person to change UFO to UAP didn't want that.
No.
That's what he or she was trying to avoid.
Exactly. But it definitely isn't. So in late 2024, there were lots of reports coming from New Jersey in the United States about these mysterious lights and unexplained movements. And there were all these blurry videos and people saying there's definitely aliens or definitely, I'll be honest, they definitely unexplained aircraft flying over New Jersey. They're really big. They're 30 meters across and they're all flying in.
30 meters across?
Yes. Oh, yes. There was a report of 30 meters across and that they were flying in formation and no one knew what they were. Even like the government of the United States has sort of said, or different versions of it, the incoming president is talking about wanting to shoot them down. It's a whole thing, right? Because I was interested in this. Look, it's never aliens. I'm just going to say it right now. But anyway, until it is. But this, all right. So I was interested. And when I went and looked up the videos of what people were talking about, I was like, where's this? Where are these videos that everyone keeps talking about where you see this car-sized drone? And when you look at it, you go, that's a blurry dot. Like, it's really, really weird. I couldn't find the things that people said that they were. I think a lot of stories come from that. But anyway, lots of blurry photos of blinking lights in the sky. And it made me start to go, I think I need to talk about this on the podcast because let's put it out there. It's not aliens. But I'm not going to come out here and say, it never will be or it can't be because we don't know. That's not how science works. But I just wanted to kind of go down the path of, it's not about debunking. It's about, let's just talk about what's going on. Because for me, this has been running for a few years. The UAP thing in New Jersey was just the latest in this 2 or 3 years of the American government releasing videos of things, of unidentified things, and very respectable pilots and navigators of military, American military jets coming out and saying, I have seen something. And you have to believe
me. Isn't it like 90% of cases it turns out to be an angel, like a biblical angel?
Normally, yes.
A ghost?
Be not afraid.
Be not afraid.
Be not afraid. Giant bull with eyes on fire screaming, be not afraid.
Look, in its defense, that's your first reaction is going to be afraid. So it's dealt with this before. And it's like, all right, first cab off the road. I know I'm a giant bull full of eyes. Be not afraid of that. That's just me. I'm just trying to do my thing.
I like the idea in heaven. Okay, Gabriel, when you go down there, we're the new human angel interaction group. So you're amazing, Gabriel, and you're bringing a whole new gospel of peace to the human race, as you know, told by your father, God himself. I don't want to tell you how to do your job, Gabriel. Like, you are the archangel of everything. You're amazing, but you are scaring them literally to death. When you turn up, you just scare them. They're not used to a big ball of flaming
eyes. What am I supposed to do about that? They've got weak, feeble, mortal minds. What am I supposed to do? Introduce myself and tell them not to be afraid of me?
Look, I'm just saying, maybe we could start there. Maybe you could just say, hi, I'm Gabriel. Hey, I have interests like your interests. I like to fly around. I like to look
I got it. All right. Sure. Be not afraid.
Perfect. Genius. All right. So I just wanted to talk about what was going on here and not, as I said, not in a, not about angels, sorry, but about these UAP things and just,
Be not afraid.
Just don't be afraid.
Just stop
monkeys.
Being afraid, and it all works out.
You running. Stop
tiny,
running.
Pitiful human. Be not afraid. I'm just trying to help.
I'm behind you, keeping up with you easily wherever you go. I can push through every object. Don't be afraid. If you're afraid of something, I can save you.
An infinite amount of pulsing eyeballs whizzing by on giant rings.
Anyway, cool. So I just want to talk about, I'm not going to go through every bit of evidence because that's just whack-a-mole, but let's just go a bit more meta on this and sort of look back at where we are, how we got here. Let's talk about our human soft gooey eyes. So our eyes are
so good for picking off gazelle.
They are absolutely great at that. And they're really good. We are very, 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 very evolved for daytime shenanigans. We are all about, our visual acuity is pretty good for daytime. Yeah, it's pretty
spot
bad.
Spot a tiger.
Yep.
Oh, you think those stripes are getting you? Like, clever. Yeah, very clever. But I see. You, I see. Yeah.
So our eyes have cones. So
I be not afraid.
There's a tiger over there.
That syntax is all over the shop. Like, that's the first thing you got to talk to HR about.
Well, I think, well, hang on. Whoa. It's a second language. He speaks Enochian.
That's true.
English and other languages. How dare you? Like,
the biblical tongue has a different syntax.
You don't speak the English good, angel of light. Good Lord. Anyway, we're getting well off track.
Hey, this is reality. Speak English.
On this planet, we speak English, angel. Welcome to Texas. Anyway, No. All right. So cones. Cones are great in your eyes, are great for color and detail, but need lots of light. And rods work in low light, but can't see color or fine detail. So when you're looking up at night, your cone cells are basically useless, leaving you with just the rods, which means you're basically colorblind and you've lost a lot of your visual power. So we also have binocular vision in the daytime. I mean, it's a very, very useful power. Two eyes, binocular vision. Binocular vision really requires you to be able to see things very clearly. And over a large distance, it doesn't make much difference at all.
Yeah,
so
it's like 30 meters or something, isn't it?
It's in that ballpark. And at nighttime, it's even worse because we don't have the visual cues. So at nighttime, you've lost basically binocular vision out to a very small distance, especially higher than what you're looking at things in the sky, put it that way. And you aren't very good at seeing in low light. So just pointing out that when you see objects in the sky, it could be, say you saw a light in the sky, and that light, it could end up to be a small drone, like a, 30 centimeters across at 100 meters away. It could easily be a commercial aircraft at 10,000 meters away, or it could be, in my case, Jupiter at 628 million kilometers away.
Or all of the sky could be a big black mat with, like, holes in it, with, like, heaven streaming through the holes like that from a visual point of view. That's
Gabriel just peeking through, just looking through, going, yes, I can see you. Yeah, hey, you stop being afraid.
Yeah, be afraid. Yeah, you be afraid. You shit your pants, buddy. I'm gonna come for you.
So we don't really know. And also, so it's not even about the hardware. Our brain also has a software issue as well. So it's not just we're getting bad data from the physical globes. It's our brains have to just put everything together. Our brain sits in a sealed box forever.
If you're lucky.
It has input basically from outside and has to make sense of all that. So it really, really makes it difficult. And something we've got is something called pareidolia, which we've talked about on the podcast before. And you start seeing shapes in like tortillas or faces in power sockets, shapes in clouds.
Love me a face.
Faces are everywhere. And that's a whole major part of pareidolia. We're so, as humans, evolved to work out what other humans' faces are doing. We see faces everywhere. I mean, the whole idea, you can just put dot, dot, and a line, and you go, oh, it's a smiley face or a frowny face. It's that simple. Really, really, really simple. Our pattern matching system evolved because it was better to mistake a rock for a bear than it was to mistake a bear for a rock. It's an important distinction to make. And our ancestors who survived weren't the ones who said, huh, that vaguely line-shaped blur in the grass is probably nothing.
So yeah, that makes sense.
We really were like, no, we have to see shapes, and it's better, much better to make a mistake. So
So you were perceiving... So you were looking at the sky and going, well, Jupiter's not real scary, but if there's something hanging over that hill, it could come for me.
I guess so. It's that unknown. I mean, even though it was something, my eyes were giving me false or weird data. My brain was interpreting incorrectly, and it was confusing me because I hadn't quite activated the rest of my brain at that point. Well, that's not fair. I think I wasn't taking into account, let's face it, we don't really know what's in the sky. So if I said to you right now, could you point, you're inside right now, could you point where the moon is and what phase it's in? Could you do that? Like, are you pointing up or are you just pointing literally at the moon?
Just at the moon.
You think, okay, that's pretty rare if you can do that. Yeah, and what phase is it in?
Yeah, yep.
What phase is it in?
Hmm?
What phase is it in? Like, what's it look like? Is it a big moon, little moon, crescenty moon?
Same size as normal.
That's the thing. We don't really know.
It's a smiley face. Smiley face version.
The two dots. People who live in rural areas away from city lights aren't necessarily better at identifying things in the night sky. Though they sometimes hear like farmers like, I know it's in the night sky. They might see more things in the sky, but it's been kind of shown that they actually don't identify things.
Also do a lot more homebrew.
So city people as well. So it's been shown a lot of the time that it's things like Venus or the International Space Station or, you know, reflected lights, some of your own lights inside, all that sort of good stuff. Seen all the time. So studies show that people living in urban areas can typically only see about 500 stars on a clear night compared to like 2,500 in truly dark sites or even more, many, many more actually. Yet urban observers report just as many, if not more, unusual area phenomena. So even though people who live in rural areas can see more things in the night sky due to less light pollution, they don't see more aliens or UAPs or whatever than city folk do, which is, I think, is an interesting point.
Hmm.
That's the brain and that's the eyes. And now this is the part I've been trying to really get onto it's basically about probability. So if you flip a coin enough times, like a million times, it's going to land in the end on the edge, probably. One in a million.
Really? Let me try that out. Hey, look at that. It landed on its edge.
Excellent. So
I guess the next 999,000 times it's not going to happen.
Every time. The more you do something, the even very unlikely things will actually happen. That's probability, right? So if you have a very, very small chance of something, you do it a lot of times, it's going to turn up. So
Heard this before? Oh, The Game. By Neil Strauss. That's The Game by Neil Strauss, where you can pick up women by just asking over and over and over.
Oh, right. Okay, fair enough. Right, I see. Yes, I suppose so. Yes. Oh,
science.
Wearing an onion on your belt or whatever it is. Ugh, terrible. So why I'm mentioning this is how I want to try and explain in a very respectful way what these credible sources, as in the military sources, pilots and everyone, say when they see aliens. They're talking about one event that they saw that they cannot explain and saying, well, that proves there's aliens or proves there's something going on. And I'm like, well, I don't know if that actually works. So I've got some numbers written here because I want to do it with numbers. So let's look at basically the US military. They've got thousands and thousands of pilots, like close to 28,000 pilots. And they've got, and they're very well trained people. They're, I'm not making any comment on that at all. They're very well trained. They know what they're doing. They know what a Boeing 747 looks like in the sky. They're very aware of what's going on. These very highly trained observers, let's say they only make a mistake 0.01% of the time when they observe something. So really, so that's one error for every 10,000 hours of flight time. So really, really low. That number's just pulled out of nowhere. We can make that number even lower if we want to. We can talk about that a bit later.
Well, if it's one in 10,000, then it's
of hours of flight. Yeah. Yes.
Hours. Then it's them making mistakes, looking at stuff for an hour every 10,000 hours.
Yes. Yeah, that's fine. That's okay. So in that hour,
that is an embarrassing hour.
Well, it's also in that hour of flight time, they find something that is inexplicable, because sometimes these things take time to go across the sky, et cetera. It's not like, bam, there it is. Sometimes they say, we tracked it for ages, and you're like, okay, cool. So they're pretty reliable. And what I'm trying to say is these are pretty reliable people. But just based on the maths, even if you look at like 0.01% of an error, that it's still 560 false UFO reports every year by the US military.
Mm.
So that's a lot. Now, even if we drop that down to 1 in 100,000 hours, an error made 1 in 100,000 hours, that's still 56 false identifications a year. That's still a lot, right? That's a lot. So the percentage number doesn't really matter. What I'm trying to say here is we can go lower. You're still getting a lot of these things over time. And even after you government investigations have gone through them and filtered out 95% of them, you know, as obvious explanations of
angels,
you missed the fact that there's a weather balloon or experimental aircraft or whatever, then you still get 28 or so unexplained cases per year. So over a decade, you're going to get these hundreds of inexplicable events purely based on probability of a misidentification from a very highly skilled pilot. Different pilots seeing different things. It is not, it would be more weird if they didn't say they saw something they didn't understand in the sky than them saying they did see something they didn't understand in the sky.
Mm.
It's just maths. So you go, well, what about the evidence such as there's these videos? Like, here's a video. The Pentagon releases videos saying, look at these videos of these things we cannot identify. And I've watched a couple of those and they're pretty cool. They're like, they were blurry and triangular nonsense, but they're still, you're like, okay. And if they can't identify it, you go, well, how come they can't identify it? And for me, this comes down to you're an expert in an area, but you're not an expert in all areas. So when people who are experts at looking at video stuff, like there's the Corridor Crew guys, and I'll put a link in the show notes about them looking at this stuff. These are CGI experts or camera experts, people who understand camera artifacts, pointing out that one of the ones with triangular lights in the sky, well, infrared cameras of a certain type create triangular lens flare, basically. Like, that's the way it works. Watch the video. You go, and they looked at that and went, well, that's the infrared camera. They go, well, how did the operator not know that? And you're like, well, because operators don't necessarily have to know everything about how the internals of their device works.
And it's kind of neat that that's what the government does, is they release this footage because they basically crowdsource the answer.
Exactly. Now, they said
like,
they
we don't know what we're talking about. We can't figure this one out. So, yeah. Hey, internet, take a look at this. You guys are clever. You guys tracked down where Shia LaBeouf was flying his flag.
Well, who'd pick that guy who effed with cats? You got that guy. So the videos share a common characteristic that makes them unreliable as good evidence. So they're really brief. They have poor video quality and they have no auxiliary data. So there's no radar, no GPS, no flight conditions, nothing. It's just a video. So even though they're released by the Pentagon, they're not fully released by the Pentagon, or maybe there's nothing else. Maybe there is no radar, GPS, flight conditions because it's not an actual thing in the sky.
Mm.
It's a mistake. So it's a pretty big thing. So given these hours of military flight recordings, even unlikely events can and will sometimes be recorded on film. Just like a pilot's making occasional misidentification, we should expect to sometimes capture weird and hard to explain footage. Once again, it'd be stranger if we didn't. All of this just, especially with the UAP stuff, just shows to me how our eyes make mistakes, our brains make mistakes. And what's really interesting is how much people don't look up in the sky. And now that people are looking up in the sky, their first thought is, well, I know it's in the sky, but actually we don't. As I said at the start, I misidentified Jupiter. We make mistakes. And we should definitely look at these things, but I think we should take it with a grain of salt that it's going to be aliens, because it's just, there's no evidence at all. And nowadays especially, you can go buy a commercial drone from any toy store and fly it around and, you know, scare your neighbors with it. And you have no clue what that thing is going to be, whether it's a tiny drone 10 meters from you or Jupiter millions of kilometers away. So there you go. That's my take on all this. And unfortunately, it's not aliens. Not yet. Maybe probably never. Sorry, everyone.
I mean, that's not the worst thing, because didn't we work out that, like, if aliens exist, the thing that they're going to want the most is resources? We got all this fresh water.
But there's tons of, well, that's a whole different thing. There's tons of water out in the solar system. Or, you know, there's water everywhere, man. You don't have to come to our planet to take it.
Hope so.
They want our women. That's what they want.
Oh, yes, I saw that documentary. So I'm not sure whether I've asked this before, but how's your memory, Gregoire?
Mine is pretty shot, actually.
Ah.
Yeah, mine is, it's interesting. I have a lot of coping mechanisms. I realize my memory has always been shot. It's not even like a getting an old thing. I wouldn't be as successful as I am without the exobraid of the internet, because I am very good at knowing I know something without remembering what it is, if that makes any sense.
Which makes our Walk of Shame segment all the more joyous.
And it means I grasp, yes, so without being able to go and do any sort of quick research. I mean, I'm pretty good at it, but I can absolutely fall down. Things like proper nouns, people's names and place names freak me out. I walk up to someone and my brain instantly goes, no name for you, but I'll give you their entire backstory. Like, God damn it. And then later it turns up. It's very weird.
My brain gives me the first letter of their name and how many letters are in their name, and then allows me to work it out as a puzzle. I was calling my new neighbor Wanda a couple of times, and after a couple of them, she was like, it's actually Megan. And I'm like, how did I do that? And I'm like, oh, sorry, I got your name upside down.
Did she back away slowly from the fence?
Yeah.
How's your memory, Dan, beyond confusing your neighbors?
Yeah, pretty good. I was chatting to the Frog Princess on Christmas Day, and in the morning. And I was talking about how when I was a kid, I got this gift when I was a kid, and then I got this gift when I was a kid, and this gift. I'm like, oh, these all must be different Christmases. And they must have been like when I was, oh, gosh, 4, 5, and 6 maybe, or even 3, 4, and 5. And I'm like, oh, so what gifts do you remember when you're a kid? And she's like, I don't remember. I guess I must have got a bike at some point, but I don't. And I'm like, oh, isn't that weird that I've got really clear memories of those events from when I was a kid? And the Frog Princess is very smart, but she doesn't have a memory for those things. And she says she doesn't have a good memory, and she can't remember movies and stuff.
Can I ask a question though, Dan? I'm not doubting your good memory, but are you remembering it? Or are you remembering stories people tell of it? Because that's the thing that happens with me is I go, I have this memory, and then people go, that didn't happen that way. And you're like, yeah, it did. And then I have a very strong memory of it. And I go, people go, then that's just what Blas said about it. That's what your dad said about it. That's what and you're like, you're remembering the story of it, not the thing itself.
Yeah. Well, I mean, look, that's how our memories work, is they pull them out and then we process them and then we put them back in and we rewrite them every single time that we recollect them.
That's true. They are rewritten. Yeah.
So that's true. I have no way of knowing. I haven't run into that scenario where people are like, that's not what happened at all.
Yeah.
But then I'm also surrounded with other people who are doing the exact same thing. So I don't have any footage of this stuff.
No, that's fair enough. That's okay. But not yet. So, yeah, okay. I'm wondering if that had come up.
But it's a very good question.
That's something as an adult I've taught myself to do is historify things, put things into a context of a narrative, and that helps me remember things. If a lump fact like, this person is called blah, I'm just not going to remember that. I find it very difficult. But if I can weave it into the tale of how I met them, if it was interesting, or if I can create a narrative, there's more things linking it together. That's been my trick to try and remember things. Even, inverted commas, dry information about UAPs or whatever. If I can tell a story, I'm going to remember it much better.
Yep. Well, I certainly am not going to forget Wanda's name. Megan's Wanda.
Yes. I've had friends of mine go, do you remember that time but you did blah and blah? And I sit there and go, I have no memory of that. None, really? Mm. And then they go, yeah. And they talk about it. And you go, that sounds like me. And sometimes I have to think and go, yeah, that checks out. That feels like a Greg thing to do. And sometimes they say something, you're like, that doesn't feel like a Greg thing. Are you positive? And they're like, oh, yeah. I'm like, okay, that feels odd because it's very out of character for whatever reason. But there are times when you go, yeah, Look, that definitely happened. I don't remember it, but that, yes, sure. I'll give you that.
Yep, I'll sign off on that one.
Yeah, add it to the memories.
So I'm not sure whether I've asked you this before, but how's your memory? I have such a good recall for movies and can almost always tell you who I went to the theater with to watch a particular movie. I love recalling actors' names and trivia I've learned. The Frog Princess can't remember if she's watched a certain movie, which I find baffling.
Yep.
Also, I don't know where the scissors are, or the painkillers, or the band-aids, or when the bins get emptied, and she nails it every time. I learned hip-hop dancing for a year for the most arrogant reason ever, which is that everything I tried was so easy, I wanted to try something I had no aptitude for.
Ooh.
Now, I don't have a good memory for putting my body into a particular pose. I had to learn the names of each move or associate it with a story element in the same way that you're memorizing people's names.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd learn a dance by going step on a bug, avoid the bullet, body roll badly, wave behind me. I needed the words to attach to the physical memory.
Yeah.
And yet when I do theatre, I learn the physical movements and it's much easier because they are already in a story. And then I can attach the actual lines of dialogue to the motions that I'm making in the...
Yeah. I remember that when I've worked with you in theatre, in scripted theatre, you're very tied to your lines and your physicality are very tied together. You're not extemporizing. Even though you're an excellent improviser, when you're not improvising, you don't use you don't learn a line and then improvise around it physically, or you don't seem to want to do that anyway. You want to link your words and your body motion very closely.
Yes. Yeah. I like choreography to sort of guide me around. Or otherwise you're going to end up on the wrong side of the stage when you got to do a thing.
Sure.
Ridiculous. Admittedly, a lot of the plays I've been involved in are very physical plays.
Yes, true. Yeah.
So I was wondering whether there are different types of memory and what makes someone good or bad at remembering stuff.
Ooh.
Now, we're not talking about orbital mechanics or the interaction of chemical reactions. This isn't the science kiddie pool. We're in the deep end now, boyo. Psychology. How the brain works. All the messy stuff.
And neurology too, not just as in the actual dendrites and neurons and oh God.
So a lot of this stuff is much harder to test and everything I discuss should be considered with a healthy amount of salt.
You're not allowed to go into people's brains and just kind of poke around.
Elon. So this is all long-term memory stuff. But just to set the stage, there are three other memory processes. Sensory memory allows you to recall the sensation of touch, sound, and other sensory information. This doesn't last long at all, and if the information is important, it gets moved into short-term memory. If you get a two-factor authentication code, you need to type it somewhere else. You may be familiar with trying to remember all six digits and then typing them without messing them up. That's your short-term memory. It will blank them in 15 to 30 seconds.
Ah.
The third type is working memory. It's closely tied to short-term memory. If you're wrapping gifts, you know where you just put the scissors. It allows you to hold all the important parts of your task in your head while it's the center of your attention. Now, on the flip side, long-term memory is broken into two types. Implicit memory is stuff like riding a bike or dressing yourself or using a fork. You remember it all subconsciously. You don't recall it to access it. It just happens because you learned it at some point in the past. Sometimes you hear something, or even if you're told at the time it's not true, your brain ingests it as a real thing. Mm. You don't remember learning it. You don't remember hearing it is false. You just know it.
Right. Okay.
On the flip side, you've got explicit memory. This is when you either experience something and then you recall the event, or you learn something and you recall the information that you learned. This is what I'm curious about.
Mm.
Memorization is closely tied to emotional weight. If something is emotionally resonant, you're going to remember it better. No one remembers where they were on the morning of September the 10th, 2001.
Sure.
If I'm recollecting movies, then I'm probably attaching a lot more emotional weight to them. My wife despises having little maggots crawl out of the bin, so she attaches emotional weight to what day the bin men arrive.
Fair enough.
One of the many things that the Frog Princess excels at is learning language. Not only can she speak French and English brilliantly, but German, some Farsi, and she was fluent in Spanish. And language is a mix of the two memories. Your native tongue is learned implicitly. Mm. You don't have to remember basic language skills. You don't have to concentrate on them when you talk. I'm doing it right now. I'm not thinking at all.
Some of the listeners
are finding this more and more apparent. But if you learn a new language, you're committing parts to memory and consciously translating. So whenever I speak French, I'm like, okay, so what is it in English I'm trying to say? And how do I convert it? Is that je pense, I think I'm, je pense de pensing? Yeah. So that's that's me using my explicit memory and poorly.
Sure.
Now the Frog Princess got to a point where her dreams were started to be in English rather than in French.
Mm-hmm.
Her language knowledge has switched from explicit knowledge to implicit knowledge. The implicit memories are stored in the basal ganglia and the cerebellum, which is like deep lizard bits.
Yeah.
And the explicit parts are stored in the hippocampus, the neocortex, and the amygdala, which are stored like they're the new bits that make us real smart.
I only ever heard that pronounced amygdala, by the way, but that's
well, that's on planet Naboo, that one. Amygdala. Okay. These are two entirely different parts of the brain. So just like I have a bigger nose than her and she's got shorter toes, it's just as possible that my hippocampus is better than hers and her basal ganglia outpaces mine. So people talk in memory in very emotional terms. Sometimes people will admit guiltily that they can't remember movies or I never remember to put the bins out. They may as well feel shame for not being able to reach the high shelf or to touch their toes.
There are tools, though, like you could have a calendar or you could have a stepladder to help you reach the top shelf. We have bad eyes, but we wear glasses sort of thing.
Yep. And you can actually train your memory as well. Mm. Like if you keep reaching for the high shelves, your children will be taller. Like that's what that's Lamarckian. That's what Lamarck said. No. He knows what he's talking about.
No.
But if you do want a better memory, there are some things that you can do. Just like weight training builds muscle, brain training can make you better at memorizing things.
Mm.
But the best thing to do to improve your memory and your brain is, fuck's sake, a healthy diet and exercise.
Ah, damn it.
It's always a healthy diet and exercise.
Yeah, I know. Eric, long-time listener and a good friend of the podcast, has got in contact with me and said they were watching the new Dune TV series that's out and they were thinking about sandworms.
There's a giant TV series?
There's a TV series, yes.
Isn't there also a movie?
There are movies, but there's a prequel TV series like 10,000 years before.
Oh, righto.
Paul Atreides sort of stuff going on. It's fine. It's perfectly cromulent. People seem to hate it. I'm like, it's fine.
It's called Grass.
Sorry?
It's called Grass. It happens 10,000 years before the...
No, it's not really set on Arrakis, thank goodness.
All right.
So the question was, the giant sandworms, those 400-meter and up giant Shire Halud things that
weird diet and, lifespans. Yep. Familiar with those guys?
All that good stuff. We've talked about it on the podcast before. Would the motion, how could a sandworm actually swim through sand? Would it be possible? Would friction stop them from actually moving through sand?
Ooh.
And I was instantly excited by this point, to the point where now we have...
Sasquatch or Bigfoot, who is who? It's all going down at the Cryptozoo.
We're talking about just their locomotion. How they move, and could they actually work? This led me down a massive
wormhole.
Wormhole, basically, of information. Trying to work out: do animals actually move this way? Like, how do they move through sand? And the answer is yes. Many animals move through sand and do it quite well. So there is something called the sandfish lizard. It's about 15 centimeters long. So it uses a wave-like motion, so it can sort of move its body back and forth, undulate left and right, and it can break up the sand and actually swim, inverted commas, through the sand. So very, very good at small scale.
Is that along
the
surface?
No, into the sand itself.
So deep into the sand? Or?
Yeah, it can go into the sand. It can go into the sand itself and go down and bury itself in the sand.
Wow.
So the razor clam creates its own quicksand, so it actually compresses and expands its shell really quickly and then pumps water into the surrounding area. And then it can actually move itself through the sand that way. Now, this isn't going to work very well for sandworms on Arrakis, Shire Halud, because, you know, water instantly kills them.
Not a lot of water.
Not a lot of water, and it instantly kills them. It's fatal to them.
Water is life.
Water is, the water of life, but not water is life.
Oh.
This water will kill you. Water will kill sandworms anyway. We won't go there. Let's not go there.
So do they have no moisture in their bodies at all?
They are. Look, let's. Wow, this is going to be a very difficult. The sand trout collect all the water. When they find water, they absorb all the water.
Right.
And the sand worms eat the sand trout.
Yeah.
And process them in some sort of way. And I think sand trout actually, in the end, if they don't get eaten, become sand worms. I think they do use water, but they can't have liquid water just like on them. It's poison to them. They can only do
like
it
like the Wicked Witch of the West.
Yeah.
Like,
yes.
How's she drinking? What's she drinking?
Maybe she's a – this is a whole different crypto. Maybe she's a Bene Gesserit. She only drinks waters of life, so she's just connected to her magic power maybe. That's a whole different crypto zoo.
Yeah.
We'll get into that. So there's things like the sand lance fish. So it can swim through water and through sand, and it does a rapid side-to-side motion, and it sort of also – it shovels its way in as well. There's things like the desert thread snake. So it combines the side-to-side motion with the sort of stabbing motion inwards, and so it can go through sand as well. This is all great. These are all animals that can move through sand. Even if we get rid of the clam one with water, lots of animals moving through sand. So problem solved, right? You just go, well, the giant worm just does one of those.
Just pushes its way through, stabs through the sand.
No problem, done problem. Thanks, Eric.
Very powerful creature.
They are very powerful creatures. And actually, that's a bit of a problem because now we have a scale problem. And I don't mean the worm scales. Sorry.
Are worms scaly?
Well, they are. They have these. I know that they have to lift them up. They have to lift up to get sand into them.
Sound like a worm at all. This sounds like a legless lizard or something.
Sheer halud is it? We're not cryptozooing the whole thing. We're just
all right.
We're just talking about locomotion.
Sorry, I'm going down a proper rabbit hole.
So the issue is we can't just scale up everything we just said then, because physics at new scales becomes very, very difficult. At a minimum of 400 meters of length, we have lots of crazy problems now. So the leading edge of the sandworm, like pushing through, if it's that powerful, will actually compress sand, so sandstone like densities.
Ah, so that's harder to get through.
And basically it's stopping itself. So it would, its motion to try and push through sand would create a barrier to itself moving. So we have a problem. It can't just ram its way through. So it'd be like swimming through concrete, basically, or trying to swim through concrete.
Can I have a guess yet?
Sure.
At what you could do?
Yeah.
I don't have a proper guess, but like I've heard of soil liquefaction.
Ah, well done. Yes.
And that's nothing to do with water getting into it.
No.
That's something to do with vibrating it hard enough that all the particles act like all the molecules in water, the whole thing becomes like a fluid.
Exactly. And soil liquefaction, in this case sand liquefaction, is part of the answer, I think, in the way I've looked at it. It's not the full answer, I think.
I've seen one of those clever YouTubers make a sand pit where it's aerated from underneath. So he aerates the sand.
Veritasium, yes. Veritasium did that.
And so it's all aerated and you can get in and it's like going into water and then he turns it off and all the sand stops moving and you're locked in place.
Yes.
So
yes.
Maybe our sandworms like have little farts all along their tummies.
I like it. Maybe that's the spice blow. They always talk about spice blow. It's just it's basically farting worms.
That's why they
around.
Want spice. It's like a chili.
Well, people say that. Sometimes people when they a flatulent, people go, "That's a bit spicy."
Yeah.
And you're like, oh, ooh. You go, that's like, the spice. The spice must flow.
Some boats do this too. They release little tiny bubbles. And so they get rid of the friction by riding on a layer of bubbles rather than a layer of water.
Yes. And that's something that we will get into as well. If maybe it is actually, when it moves, maybe it is actually creating a barrier or an air barrier around itself. So that's absolutely part of it as well. I think it could be anyway.
So it hydrofoils.
Yes.
No.
Without, not hydro. Hydro? Yes.
What's air?
We don't think air is a liquid.
An atmosphoil. And you stick a rocket onto one of those sandworms and it's going to go like a bat out of hell.
Look, you should write the next Dune series. It wouldn't be any sillier. So that'd be great. All right. So we have a problem. We can't.
Fast and the Duniest.
Here's some physics issues. Movement creates a lot of cascading issues. So enormous friction generated heat. So as these things try and move, the amount of heat is going to be incredible.
Hard to swim through glass.
But yes, well, it's, and maybe that could be an answer as well. Moving wall of compressed sand at the front, so that's the very dense, and basically sand behavior changes at large scales. We have a problem. All right, so here's what I'm thinking. It's a sequence of things. So what you need to do, you need to be able to break up the ground and make it something that makes it easier then to move through, and then something to push you through it. So there needs to be I think there's three answers to this. It all synchronizes together as three things.
Mm.
And I think that's it. So it's kind of like if you were like a snow plow, a road salter, and a jet engine all working together, basically. You've seen jet engine before. Now,
you wouldn't need to plow it if you were like consuming all the sand in front of you and spitting it out the back.
Well, that's a good point. Yes, that's a good point. To talk about its biology a little
bit. It's a filter feeder, isn't it?
It's sucking in all the sand trout and storing the spice as well. I think it's mainly, it's looking for spice to gather together, and it uses all that in some sort of, I'll say now, all I'm going to say about that is I looked into it, and this is, just part of the story. It's almost, they seem to be powered by some kind of biological fusion. So a lot of energy is created, like a lot.
Well, that could come in handy for moving through the through the sand.
That will power this mad system that I've come up with.
And if it's fusion, what if it eats a big chunk of sand and then compresses it real small? It's basically making a tunnel for itself.
Yes. You're right. It doesn't have to push a lot of the sand out of the way because I think it's going through its system.
Mm.
A lot of it is going to get filtered out and then shot out the back or dropped out the back. So here's what I'm thinking, though. So I think on the outer layer of the creature, you have a wave motion system. It waves back and forth in synchronized patterns. It's going to have scales, so like a shark skin, so that it can actually filter the sand in certain ways around itself, not just through itself. And it also means it can grip when it can actually lock down on the sand like a worm can, and it can actually push itself forward. So it's got a mechanical advantage there. So some parts of it are moving, some parts of it are wiggling sideways, wiggling up and down, and also
like it was covered in escalators.
But yes, I like that. That's a good way of putting it. So it's moving a lot of things. Also, what I call the middle layer, it's internally, it's actually doing dry liquefaction of the sand around it through mechanical force. So its forward wave motion creates a compression wave, so it compresses it, but its lateral shaking breaks up the sand structure. It produces, I think, a low-frequency resonance, so like a rumble. And that actually creates sand particle suspension, the thing you're talking about before. So you actually start making a liquefaction of the sand. It could make a subsonic sound, and a very large creature could make that sound, make much lower frequency sound. The bigger it is, it's easier to create. And that would vibrate a lot, the sand around it, close to its skin, creating that liquefied kind of feeling. So you've got the outer layers shimmering about. You've got it generating this field, so to liquefy the sand around it.
So if you had a different frequency playing at the same time, you could interfere with their frequency and they'd get really upset, right?
Well, yes.
Like if you put a big thing out in the desert where it was going boom, 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 like making a frequency, you'd be like, oh, no, this sucks. I can't move properly. I got to take care of that.
Actually, that's a very good point. Why does it come to thumping? Maybe that's a lovely idea. It's interfering with the... It's motion or it's something about its biology. And it's like, no, it's probably a minor irritant compared to the power of Shire Halud, but it'd be like, oh, that thing's really annoying. It's making me slightly less efficient. I'm going to go there and mess it up. I love it. And then finally, internally, it's like the inner layer, you have a independent segment control so that it can actually expand some parts of its body and contract other parts of its body and push itself forwards. So
and that's how a normal worm moves around too, isn't it?
Yes, that's right. So it can do all. So you've got the lateral motion of breaking everything up. You've got the liquefaction of the sand due to subsonic frequencies, and then it pushes itself forward on it. And this should make it much more efficient at moving through sand. Still take a metric truck ton of energy to do this, but as we said before, biological fusion. So we're not going to talk about that. It can do it quite well.
I mean, if you could harness that... And the spice trade, is your second major import from Arrakis.
Well, yeah, that's it. You could have the worms. I did some research into efficiency of animals. So the best bacteria convert about 70% of their food into energy, which is pretty efficient.
That's great.
We turn about 40% of it into energy, what we eat, like it's a lot of waste. But
all that prepackaged stuff, processed stuff.
All that plastic in our urine. And so I think a sandworm would have to be somewhere in the order of like 95% efficient, like something crazy like that. Like it's hard to know. It would have to be much more efficient.
Well, if you're using fusion, then the concept of efficient food breaks down, doesn't it? Because you're getting energy out of your food, which is inherent in its nature. In its
yes, that's molecular. That's where we'd get the 95% from. I don't really want to go into how it makes biological fusion because, you know, it's not a real thing. But it's got something to do with spice, something to do with sand trout. It's doing something with those things. Maybe it's the water of life. I just don't know. I don't think anyone knows. I think it's all made up. But yes, this is where the efficiency comes from. It's a type of fusion, people keep saying. So you go, well, that allows us to have a very efficient creature that can create a lot of energy based on a very small amount of power, food.
We try not to mention it's all made up in the Walk of Shame. It undermines the segment.
It makes Greg sad. To answer Eric's question, I think, yes, it is possible that giant sandworms could move through sand. They'd have to come lots of adaptions to come over the friction issue, but there are analogs in the real world that we can scale up and do in different ways that would mean an animal that big could actually move if it had a very, very powerful power supply and was very, very, very heat resistant, because it's going to generate a ton of friction around itself. Oh, I didn't even mention that. It probably enough heat that it would probably liquefy the sand close to its body, like that level of heat, crazy amount of sand, which would be good for a moment until you stopped moving. That'd be a problem. It would also have difficulty starting motion. It would take a lot of effort to begin moving, but once it got moving, it came over the coefficient of friction, and it could keep itself moving quite relatively easy with all these processes. That's it. That's my how do sandworms work. Eric, I hope that was useful to you.
You can catch a big fish with a sandworm. Need a big hook. Hook would probably collapse under its own weight.
I wonder if Ilsan Gahib, I wonder if the Bene Gesserit's, the Kwisatz Haderach could hook a sandworm and catch the largest fish in the universe. I mean, that's going to be in the sequels.
You say you're bad at memorizing proper nouns, but I think you're just focusing on the wrong ones.
Probably.
Welcome to the Walk of Shame, where Greg doesn't have any Walk of Shames for me. I have one Walk of Shame. Greg said that the right-hand side of his brain controlled his left eye, and that's not right. I knew it wasn't right when I heard it, but we continued moving forwards and I didn't stop us.
Oh, there you go.
Now, it is true that everything below the neck on the right-hand side is linked to the left-hand side of the brain and vice versa.
Ooh.
There are a handful of theories proposed as to why this is, but none have gained general recognition.
Right.
One is called the axial twist theory.
Mm-hmm.
It explains why this flip happens and contends that when we are conceived, the bit that will turn into our nose and the bit that will turn into our spine are facing the same direction.
Weird.
The bit that will be our head spins left 180 degrees and then the body parts form. That stuff that turns into the nervous system is thus crossed over itself.
Ah, so everything above the neck wouldn't be.
So this means that everything in the head is still linked up right to right and left to left.
Huh.
Except I was wrong about this. The twist doesn't happen in the part that will become the neck. The twist happens halfway through the brain.
Oh, my God.
So things wired up to the forebrain are on the correct side and things connected to the midbrain are flipped.
Hang on. Does that mean that your visual cortex is at the back of the brain, the occipital lobe at the back of the brain?
Yeah, but it's – well, we'll get there. We'll get there.
Okay, sorry.
We'll get there because it's even more complicated.
Oh, my God.
So your nose is not flipped. Your left nostril, right. Well, it all goes into the same chamber, but if they went if they had to be decoded by different parts of the brain, they would be right to right, left to left.
Got it.
The muscles that control your eyes are not flipped.
My goodness.
So your left eye muscles that point your eyes are connected to your left part of the brain and right to right.
Okay.
The eyes themselves are not flipped. The optic nerve is flipped back to front.
What?
So the So you control the movements of your eye with the correct side of your brain, but the information runs down and crosses over before entering the brain to be processed by the opposite side.
How do we even stand up and oh my goodness.
Then we go, actually, I don't think I mentioned this last time. I went to the optometrist and I was like, how does the eye work? There are multiple parts to the lens. He goes, yeah, here's a thing. Like, here's how it works. This is this. And the amazing thing is if you took away one bit, wouldn't work.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh, well, I mean, that's not quite true because you get rid of the lenses and you would still see a blurry image and that would be useful. Yeah. And he goes, oh, yeah, but what uses are, like, how does the retina come to be there? And I'm like, and in my head, I was like,
no.
Oh, you've picked the wrong mark for this, my friend.
Yeah.
I've written a book about this.
Yes. Yeah. What are you talking about?
I was like, you know what? This guy's about to be poking around in my eyeball. I'm not going to give him any reason to weed me out of the gene pool.
No, that's weird because you go, even having a light-sensitive part of your skin that can detect shadow of a big old fish coming at you.
Yeah, yeah. So he's got this is the old evolutionary biology.
Yeah, it's
sorry,
so
the,
annoying.
Or the creator stuff.
What's the point of half a wing that doesn't flap or properly?
Yeah.
Like, no, there's tons of useful stuff. What's irritating to me about that is what they're using it is like, oh, well, it's creationism versus evolution. Evolution has to have been that way. And you're like, it just shows a lack of imagination on your part or a lack of realizing how things work. It doesn't show the thing you think it shows. It shows that you don't understand something.
My optometrist is a young earther, it turns out.
No!
I'm assuming by this conversation, my dentist out of nowhere, while I've got my jaw opened up with all these things, is like, oh yeah, no, I don't consider myself a feminist. I'm like, So I'm like, oh man, what is going on in my neighborhood with my professionals?
And anytime you talk about space stuff, like, you know, Uber drivers and all the rest, but even like my dentist has said, like, oh, so astronomy, like, and they ask questions and it's fine. You're having a conversation with the person that's in your mouth. And then you go, I wonder how long it'll take. And for an Uber driver or for your dentist, it's always roughly the same amount of time when they start going, yes, but what about God? And you're like, nothing to say about that.
Please concentrate on the road and get me where I'm going.
Well, I don't mind, but it's kind of like this weird idea of like, oh, you do your space stuff, cool. And then you invariably it's like back in time. But where did that come from? Where did that come from? And you go, no, I know where this is going. And then and people don't mean it in a gotcha way, but it's just like, so what do you think about God? You're like,
Look, from a very positive point of view, maybe a lot of people are flailing around for meaning.
Oh, yeah,
and
of course,
just
of course.
Like this conversation.
And it's how I always do with it too. I always talk about how, as a scientist, you can only study what you can detect. And so when we create an angel detector, a heaven detector, then I'll have an answer. But right now, we can only look at the phenomena around us, and the phenomena around us that we can detect says X, Y, and Z.
It's just a dial, like from Ghostbusters, and the needle is on like "Be not afraid," and then it goes up to "Be afraid."
On the needle, it would just be the number 7. Oh, that's how many angels are dancing on this needle. Fantastic.
Ah,
thank you.
That's very good. That's very clever. All right, so we're only halfway through this.
Oh, God.
Because this is all the stuff I discovered. Then we got an email from Rick Lepoidovin.
Right.
And he shared that it's even more complicated than that.
Oh, God. Oh, no. Hang on. So at the moment, I don't want to know at the end. Am I right or am I wrong right now? Where we stand right now.
Oh, yeah, you're wrong.
I'm wrong.
Oh,
okay,
hang on.
I'm wrong. Okay.
You said...
I said it was crossed my.
You said the right hand side of his brain controlled his left eye, and that's incorrect.
Yes.
The right hand side controls the right eye. The optic information is processed by the opposite one.
I'll let you have that because of imprecise language.
Yeah.
But from what I was saying is not really. I wasn't really caring about what was moving the muscles around. I was talking about what part of my brain was looking through the eye.
Oh,
but
so
that's okay.
So you remember exactly what you're saying? Because
I feel
you might want
I
to
do.
Wait a couple more paragraphs before you confidently wade into that one.
No, I don't. I was just wondering if that's what I was trying to get at. Well, go on, please. I'm interested.
So both eyes can see the same information. Each view is slightly different as they are offset by the width of your eyes. Also, the left eye can see a bit more of the left-hand side and the right eye can see a bit more of the right-hand side. This is your peripheral vision.
Can I just be pedantic here for a moment?
Sure.
I don't know if it matters, but you just said both your eyes can see the same information. Absolutely not true. Each eye is seeing a different thing, which you just said, separated by so many centimeters. It's not the same. They're seeing a different view of the world.
Look, this is true.
I don't know if that's important.
It's different photons hitting each eye.
Yes.
Like if you've got an apple in front of you, there's like an apple, but the information is bouncing. The photons are hitting the apple and different photons are going into different eyes. Okay, so, you're right.
No, I'm not trying to be clever. I was just it's different information that is bound together. That's what gives you binocular vision.
Yes.
Okay, yeah. Cool. All right.
Like from a very human point of view, if you're getting visual information, it's coming from in front of you and it's the same thing for both eyes. Even though technically it is two different views. And that's important.
Put your glasses on and you're getting like the internet pumped into one eye. Don't mind me. Move on.
So the information from the left eye runs underneath the brain into the center where it meets the information from the right eye.
Oh my God.
This happens in the optic chiasm. Mm. Both sets of information are merged into left-hand peripheral, center binocular information, and right-hand peripheral. That amalgam of information is then cut right down the middle. Every bit of information from the left-hand side of your nose that has been gathered by both eyes is sent to the right-hand side of the brain.
Oh.
And every piece of information from the right-hand side goes to the left-hand side of your brain.
No, it's awful.
But you were saying that your left brain was closing your right eye and your right brain would keep your left eye open. Muscles don't switch over. But maybe your brain was making the decision not based on what muscles were laziest, but what part of the brain didn't want to process early in the morning.
Sure. Potentially. Oh, my God.
So you can use whatever side of your body to walk the walk of shame. You will just end up walking in circles.
Sure. That's incredible. Oh, it's so messy. It's such... What sort of God would design such a crazy system? That's mad. How the hell does any part of it work is just, which we don't know. Oh, my goodness.
Look,
is such a soup.
I follow the Factorio Reddit, and there's not a lot of people posting in there about the easiest way to do stuff. Some people will just pick a really big challenge, and maybe God is just like, okay, hear me out. I flipped everything halfway through because I've played this so many times. And what I did is I spun the embryo like at a random point partway. Like I just twisted the brain halfway through and to see whether I could still get it to work. And oh my God, you guys are not going to believe what I did.
That's right. They love hip hop. These ones love hip hop. Who would have thunk it? They're into capitalism and hip hop. It's crazy.
This is amazing. I'm giving you flair for this, God.
That takes a lot. And guess what? I'm going to send Gabriel to go and scream at them, but not be afraid. It's going to be amazing.
Probably for the best, actually. Yeah. Get him prepared. Yeah, that's that checks out. You have been listening to Dan at smartenough.org.
Also, Greg at smartenough.org.
We'd like to thank all the people who support us, especially the ones who give us a certain amount of money at an arbitrary amount.
Oh, yes.
So crazy. A big thank you to Andrew Whitehurst, Mariana Scott, Catherine Cook, Andrew Potts, Gronya Maguire, Matt Ewers, Amy Greensbury, Al Batson, Ivan, Matthew Toy, Andrew Trousdale, Britta Rogoski, Lindsay Jenkinson, Steve Stewart, Ilana Mitchell, and Grant Roberts. Thank you all so much for being tier two members of the podcast.
Thank you, everyone. Can I just say, I find it lovely. We've had a few people email us to say that due to life changes, some good, some bad, that they can no longer give money. And I'm always super touched that and some people just drop off, which is fine too. That's totally fine. But when people email us and say, hey, I'm really sorry. And you're like, you don't need to be sorry about it.
Oh no, they're dead to me. They're dead to me. Even the ones who are still on a lower tier, dead to me.
No, and it's always lovely when the people go, I'm really sorry. You have nothing to apologize for. Thank you for supporting this madness. And if you continue supporting, it's great. If you come back, that's great. And if you just listen to us, that's great. It's so touching and lovely. Don't listen to Dan. He's a bad person.
Oh, yeah. But that's what they're tuning in for. Case in point, the tier three. Okay. So, Gregoire, this is the tier threes which I have to insult because mm-hmm. they're paying us more money than they should be doing. Usually doing these insults is the most tiring part of the podcast, Gregoire. Like, it's just because it was easier to begin with, and now I really have to push myself to find a theme. But once I hit the theme, then it all sort of falls into place.
Fantastic.
Maybe 15 minutes. Well, this time I bit off more than I can chew. I decided that I was going to do palindrome insults.
Oh, my goodness.
Now, what's a palindrome, Gregoire?
The same word forward as backwards?
Same word or sentence.
Sentence? Oh, okay, right. Uh-huh.
So, obviously, a man,
a plant, and a canal. Panama!
One of the greats. One of the best palindrome of all time. Absolutely beautiful. Now, I figured that the internet must have tools for easily writing and testing palindromes.
Yes.
I was 100% wrong.
Oh.
So I spent the first 2 hours, writing a web tool to help me write palindromes. I then spent another 2 hours coming up with these insults, and it was simultaneously far too much time, Gregoire, and not nearly enough time. So.
A lot of caveats going on here.
Tom Seary. Your palindrome, your insult palindrome.
Here we go.
Moths art deified trash Tom.
Moths art deified trash Tom.
Yes. Yeah.
Moths are or art?
Moths art.
Art, as in the old, okay, moths art.
So the moths art deified trash Tom. So this trash Tom who has been deified by the moths art.
Okay, right. Good.
So, we're all familiar with Lanio del Sur in the Philippines, I'm assuming.
What?
It's a commonplace, very popular tourist destination, I assume. Lanio del Sur in the Philippines. Okay.
I thought it was a singer for a moment.
Rick Le Poitevin. And thanks a lot for making it easier, Poitevin.
You could just use Rick. You didn't have to.
That's what I ended up having to do. Okay. Lanio del Sur, Rick, Cirrus, Ledu Anal.
What?
Obviously, I'm using the, putting a little asterisk next to the let, where it's where I'm not, the let, it's using a sort of an accent from a different culture. Lanio del Sur,
yes.
Rick, Cirrus, Ledu Anal. So. That's your palindromic insult.
Wow.
Palindromes are hard.
Palindromes are hard. Yes. But I'd like to point out, you created this rod for your back. You absolutely went, you know what I'm going to do? Hit myself very hard in the groin and then write a device that helps me hit myself in the groin.
Yes, but you've signed me up for the groin hitting membership.
No. I signed you up for the lightly spank yourself on the bottom with your own hand. You've gone, I'm going to hit myself in the groin. There's a difference
Look,
here.
That's I'm all. Running out of other things to hit myself with at this point.
Right, okay,
all I have are rods for my back.
And groin, it seems.
Oh, groin for days. Groin for days. Ladies.
Oh, God.
I love to slip one of those in.
Oh.
Ladies.
No. Oh, gross.
All right. Finally, Scott Driscoll. Scott, you be level buttocks.
Sure.
God.
One thing I say about Scott, he is level buttock.
Yeah, and the U is not the word U, and the B is not the word okay. B, and buttocks is spelt without a K. This has been really hard.
Well, bravo, I think.
Thank you so much.
I'm applauding the effort more than anything
thank
else.
Thank you. Thank you. Also, finally, thank you to Michael Barnes, Eric Wilson, Joey Wesley, Gyroscope, which is what Morden O'Hare is apparently calling himself now.
Gyroscope! Cool.
I think that's like a really old nickname. He pasted into Patreon, but for some reason it turned up, and now I'm calling him Gyroscope. Thank you to you guys. You guys are my race car.
Oh, very good. That's nice.
If you would like to play around with the Palindroma web app, you can find it linked to in the show notes or get along to invisiblespiders.com, which is my personal website where all that sort of nonsense correlates. I have been writing palindromes and posting them on Blue Sky like all week. Like, I'm like, if I wrote this, I'm gonna start writing palindromes.
Write that. You've got a whole novel in palindromes from now on. Go a novel. Wow. Novel of that's one from the. Don't do that. Sounds like madness.
Yeah. Oh, it's hard enough to write a sentence. It's ridiculous.
Yeah. Wonder what the longest actual useful. I have to look it up. I'm sure. Like, what's the longest? Canal Panama is pretty good. Yep. I wonder if there's a longer one that makes sense.
I don't think I've seen one that long because I've been looking at them. I've been reading through commonly used palindromes, and there's a bunch of good ones out there. There's a Toyota race safe fast car, a Toyota. That's not too bad.
Yeah. Oh, my God. Okay, this is the one I just found. Doc, note I dissent. A fast never presents a fatness. I diet on cod.
Not too bad.
Not too bad.
Palindromes are hard, ladies and gentlemen.
It's a bit messy in the middle. A fast never prevents a fatness. That doesn't that's not really a thing. And also, yeah, that's fine. I don't mind. There you go.
One thing that was interesting is once I started posting on Blue Sky, I found that there are some other people doing palindromes who are Spanish. And I wonder whether different languages lend themselves to palindromes more effectively. Because you know what doesn't work in palindromes in English? Like most of our final consonants.
Yeah.
T-I-O-N.
T-H-T and that sort of stuff. Yeah,
unless you're talking about the video game Neuter, there's not a lot of stuff that you can.
Yeah.
E-N-G, useless. K in any word, gibberish.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Good point. You really cut out a lot of letters. Wow, there you go. Well, I'm glad this is a useful use of your time. That's fantastic.
Sorry, where did I give you the impression?
This is what he does to you, ladies and gentlemen. He puts his whole self on the line and his livelihood that he could have been earning serious money helping you feel bad about yourself in palindromes. Some say the word legend is overused. And as we always like to say...
I'm not sure I've asked this before, but how's your memory? Is that whenever you read about the economy, you just replace that word with the phrase rich people's yachts?
Kind of.
Helps put things in perspective a bit.
Yeah, kind of. I know you're being funny with that. Balance in all things. Balance in all things.
Burn it all down, I reckon.
I think.
Have I not been clear about that on the podcast? I have been playing video games pretty consistently.
Wow.
Since the flood.
Like Noah, like this.
That's all Noah did after he arrived on Mount Sinai.
Antediluvian GTA. That's what it was.
Booted up his Atari 2600 and just played Battle over and over again.
Pong. Boop. Boop. Boop.
As the points went up 2x2.
Yeah, very good.
I'm brushing the cobwebs off. We were playing Dungeons & Dragons on Friday night. And Tom, he said, you noticed that there's the stellar event occurring of these two comets that actually intersect. So they form an X with their tails. And I'm like, well, that's not how comets.
Oh, no.
That's not how comets work. It suddenly Kai knew an awful lot about how comets worked. I was like, oh, that one must be really magic, that one, because it's going in it's going perpendicular to how all comets work. Yeah. And Tom's like, what are you talking about? I'm like, well, which is something fun that I learned when I was eight. I'm always fascinated when you hit something which you learned when you were eight, and then grown-ups are like, what are you talking about?
No, I'm
like,
yeah.
Dinosaurs and humans never lived together. They were separated by 64 million years.
Yeah.
And people are like, oh, I didn't know that. And there's a part of me which is like, well, I learned that when I was six. So what the fuck is wrong with you? It's like, no. Everyone learns everything for the first time.
Absolutely.
Being kind is more important than being right.
Ah, did you write you dick at the end of it? That would have been fun. Like, you know, being kind is better than being right. You dick. See?
Yeah, that I feels like that would undermine the message.
Nothing means anything. It'd be like saying you didn't win the science award because your English was low. No, it's English is not a science subject, right? English is still important. We all love English, blah, blah, blah. Anyway.
Didn't win the physics award because you can't run fast enough.
Yes. Exactly. Yeah. Yes.
Sorry, Mr. Hawking.
So, yes, no Nobel Prize for you in physics because you can't get it. Get out of the chair and get it. You have to pick it up. Otherwise, you're not a real physicist.